The Haunted Cabin. Geoffrey Avalon, host of the Black Widower banquet that month, gazed benignly at the five other seated widowers, and at his guest for the evening, Marcellus D'Arienzi. Henry, that unparalleled waiter, would soon be removing the main course plates when the last bit of the roast goose, red cabbage, and potato pancakes would be gone. "I have a rather odd tale that I would like to tell you all before the business end of the meeting begins," Avalon said in his stately baritone. Emmanuel Reuben looked up at him owlishly through the thick lenses of his glasses with an unaccustomed bonhomie, and patted a stomach full of goose. "Go ahead, Jeff, but don't be tedious." "I shall try not to be," said Avalon gravely. "It happened 2 weeks ago. I was on a business trip and had taken a room in a hotel. I needn't mention the name of the hotel or of the city to avoid tedium for Manny, and because they have nothing to do with the story. My wife was not with me. That is essential. I had several hours one afternoon between appointments, and I thought I might as well take a nap," he added defensively. "I don't know about the rest of you, but since I am past my first youth, I find 40 winks after lunch to be most helpful." "We'll grant you that, Jeff," said Thomas Trumbull, scowling under the crisp, tight waves of his white hair. "I've been known to take such naps myself, and Jim Drake is taking one now." "Not at all," said Drake indignantly. "I was just resting my eyelids." "Let me go on," said Avalon. "I fell into a light doze and suddenly felt the poke of a finger on my shoulder, quite a hard poke. Naturally, I woke up at once, and in the confusion of sudden wakefulness, I cried out, 'Who? What?' and sat up in bed. The room, as I suppose you can guess, was, except for me, empty. It was afternoon, the sunlight was slanting in, there were no dim corners, all was bright, and the room was empty. The door was securely locked with an inner chain in place. The windows were locked, and they were, in any case, 16 sheer stories above the street." "Did you look under the bed?" asked Mario Gonzalo, grinning and smoothing his ascot tie. "No," said Avalon, with a touch of hauteur. "I did not look under the bed. There was no room under the bed for a medium-sized dog, let alone a human being. However, I did inspect the bathroom and the closet. Nothing there. And there were no connecting doors to other rooms, by the way. I was alone, absolutely alone." "So?" said Roger Halstead, pushing away his plate. "So, who poked me?" "Oh, for God's sake!" exploded Trumbull. "It was a dream! Haven't you ever dreamed, Jeff?" "No," said Avalon, hunching his formidable eyebrows low. "It was not a dream. I know it was not a dream. Someone poked me." "Listen," began Trumbull. "I've had dreams." "Never mind your dreams," said Avalon with unaccustomed abruptness. "This was not a dream." Trumbull shook his head. "I've never known you to be this stubborn, Jeff, and this stupid." The guest, D'Arienzi, now spoke for the first time since the dinner had begun. He smiled down at his stewed pears and said, "What Jeff is doing here, gentlemen, is posing a locked room puzzle. Something has happened in a locked room that could not have happened. My friend Jeff is an honest man who is presenting an honest problem, and we, or at least you gentlemen of the club, must puzzle out the solution. And saying it was just a dream is not an acceptable solution, is it, Jeff?"
"No," said Avalon, still testy. "I know the solution, and so do you, Marcellus, because I told you earlier in the evening. But I want the Black Widowers to figure it out. I'm telling it to them in orderly fashion, if the idiots would only allow it."
Reuben said, "You're the host, Jeff. You control the evening. Order silence and go on."
Avalon growled, "Silence!" "In the empty room, then, I was forced to consider the possibility of a supernatural warning."
The five other widowers at the table, rationalists all, scrambled to their feet and, the order for silence forgotten, yammered their indignation. D'Arienzi kept his seat and smiled. Avalon raised his hands and thundered, "Silence!" "I don't say I accepted the supernatural as an explanation. I merely say I was forced to consider it.
I don't believe in supernatural influences, but even my own firmest beliefs cannot be accepted by myself as unshakable and invulnerable. Do you mind pursuing rationality that far?" "As a matter of fact," said Roger Halstead quietly, as he mopped his high pink brow with his handkerchief, "our society is so permeated and drenched with supernatural beliefs of any number of kinds and sorts that even the firmest skeptic may be corrupted, at least momentarily, if the conditions are right." "Thank you, Roger," said Avalon. "It's exactly what I would have wanted to say. It was 2:15 when it happened, and if it hadn't been for the fact that I had a wife in New York, I would have dismissed the matter. But I couldn't. Some 45 years of marriage isn't something you can dismiss lightly. I phoned her. She answered at once. I don't know what I would have done if she hadn't answered, if she had been out shopping, for instance. I might well have raced home and made a complete fool of myself. But she did answer. I asked how things were, and everything was perfectly in order, so I relaxed. And that left only the primary problem, who had poked me." "It was a dream," said Trumbull stubbornly. "No," said Avalon, "it wasn't. After a while, I gave up the problem and decided to try to sleep again. And I became aware that when I prepare for sleep, at least if I'm alone in bed, I wrap my arms tightly about myself. I also know that in the borderland between sleep and wakefulness, my muscles twitch. I have felt them do so, and my wife has commented on it with some amusement. And of course, that was the solution. It fully explains the locked room puzzle without calling upon the supernatural. In the process of falling asleep, my own finger had twitched and jabbed my shoulder." Note: the reader may be interested to know that this matter of a poke in an empty room and a panicky call to a wife happened to me recently in exactly the manner described here. I.A. End of note. Avalon looked about triumphantly and said, "And that is why I have brought my friend, Marcellus Darienzi, Ph.D., as my guest. He has a natural connection with this sort of thing. And I have managed to finish my story without delaying the grilling too much, so let's proceed. Tom, you skeptic, I appoint you the griller." Thomas Trumbull studied Avalon's guest. Narienzi was a cheerful-looking man with tufts of hair down his cheeks, and only a tuft on top of his head. He wore old-fashioned, round-rimmed glasses, and a vest under his suit jacket, and he had an air of permeating benevolence. Trumbull said, "Mr. Darienzi, Marcellus, I will get right to the point without setting you the usual first task of justifying your existence. What is the so-called natural connection Jeff says you have with this mad dream story he told us?" Avalon looked offended, but kept silent. Darienzi said mildly, "The connection, I suppose, is that I'm a psychic researcher." "Oh, Lord," muttered Trumbull. "Oh, Lord." Then, more loudly, "Does that mean you're trying to prove the existence of telepathy, spoon-bending, ghosts, and fairies at the bottom of the garden? Have you been working on poor Jeff so that he's beginning to be screwed up?" Avalon looked daggers, but still said nothing. Darienzi said, "Why no, Tom, rather the opposite. I've spent my time investigating and disproving reports of the existence of telepathy, spoon-bending, ghosts, and fairies at the bottom of the garden." "Do you mean," put in Reuben suddenly, "like the Amazing Randy?"
"Something like," agreed Darienzi, "but not completely.
The Amazing Randy is probably the most doughty knight in the fight against hokum and pseudoscience that there is.
But he is much in the news, and the practitioners of nonsense try to avoid him, so that his task is harder than it might otherwise be. I'm not the skilled magician that Randy is, which puts me under a disadvantage. However, I maintain a low profile. I stay out of the limelight so that I am easily accepted as a believer, and the fakers don't go to any special efforts to fool me. For that reason, I can usually detect what it is they're really doing. I might say that I have never found any convincing evidence in favor of anything we might call supernaturalism or the paranormal. I'm ready to be convinced that such things exist, but only if the evidence is solid, and it never has been in my experience."
"In that case," said Trumbull, "I presume you don't approve of Avalon's action in calling his wife."
It did no harm, said Darienzi. His momentary weakness in phoning his wife is something any of us might have fallen prey to. As Roger said, the social milieu in which we live makes it almost impossible not to weaken on occasion. And I surely approve of Jeff's final rationalistic solution of this locked room mystery of his. Gonzalo interrupted. Pardon me, Marcellus, I don't want to take offense, but we have all heard of the amazing Randy. I have, for one, but I have never heard of you. He looked about. Has anyone? I mean, besides Jeff? I hope not, said Darienzi with deep sincerity. I said I keep a low profile, and I mean it. I don't want anyone to know me in my capacity as a psychic researcher. That Jeff knows is partly the result of accident, but I am confident of his discretion, and I hope that... He looked about uncertainly. Jeff said, As I told you, Marcellus, nothing that is said at a Black Widower's banquet is ever repeated outside these walls. That assurance extends to our waiter, who is, in point of fact, a member of the club. Well, said Darienzi with a remnant of worry in his voice, I'll accept that. Halstead cleared his throat and said, Marcellus, what is your doctorate in? Psychology. And do you work as a psychologist? Do you have a university position? Are you in private practice? No to all three questions, Roger. My work consists entirely of the psychic research I've mentioned. Halstead cleared his throat again and said, I'm a math teacher at a junior high school, and am therefore very knowledgeable on the subject of inadequate payment. How the devil do you make a living on your psychic research? I don't, said Darienzi. At least, I don't have to. My father saw to it that I was left with a secure and entirely adequate income, so that I can quite afford to spend my life in doing something I consider very worthwhile and interesting, without regard to payment. Lucky fellow, muttered Halstead. Trumbull re-entered the grilling with what was almost a roar. All right, so you don't need money. But do you mean to tell us that you have no hankering for fame or at least recognition? Don't you want to have people know of your work? Darienzi reddened slightly. Why there, Tom, he said, you touch a tender point. We live in a social environment whose orientation toward success is as corrupting as its orientation toward supernaturalism. The truth is, and please let me remind you of your assurance of confidentiality, that I am writing a book describing my experiences. It will be a startling one, and I have many amusing stories to tell that are not at all known to the general public. I don't suppose it will make a great deal of money. Debunking books never do. Still, I have a publisher, and I'm enjoying the task. But you'll blow your cover, said Gonzalo. I mean, you'll become known, and then you'll have the disadvantages of that. Scarcely, said Darienzi with a small laugh. My picture won't appear in the book, and I plan to use a pseudonym. Any success I achieve in the book will redound to the work I've done and not to me personally. Of course, as I approach the end of my life, I may reveal my identity if a hankering for any personal fame I can garner in this way overcomes me. What progress are you making on your book? Asked Reuben. Writing isn't an easy job. Manny knows, put in Gonzalo at once. He's a writer, and it surely doesn't come easy to him. You'll find, said Reuben loftily, that writers have much to suffer at the hands of ignorant and captious critics. But what progress are you making? As Mario said, writing isn't easy, at least not for me. But I'm almost finished with the first draft. I made major progress late last summer when I was able to use a friend's Vermont home for 2 weeks. You remember, Jeff, that Harry Weinstein had to spend most of the summer in Europe, and he was kind enough to let me have his summer home for the latter part of August. It was very peaceful and quiet, and perfect for what I needed. As a matter of fact, he had a special bonus for me. You'll like my place, Marcellus, he said, because I've heard a haunted cabin has turned up in the vicinity, and you once said you were interested in such things. And so I had. Such remarks do manage to slip out, despite anything I can do. I've often thought it would be an accumulation of such slips that would blow my cover, to use Mario's phrase, and not my book. Halstead asked with interest, Have you investigated haunted houses? Certainly, said Darienzi. Half a dozen rather well-known cases, and a number of trivial ones. How do you go about it? You examine the place rather meticulously by daylight, but the important test is to spend the night there. A dark and stormy night would be best. Darienzi grinned. But unfortunately, the condition of most haunted houses is such that a stormy night would produce as much rain and wind indoors as outdoors. Halstead said, And you've actually slept in such houses?
Of course. Darienzi looked about good-humoredly.
Come, you're all rationalists. I heard you jumping all over poor Jeff a while ago. How many of you would prefer not to sleep in a supposed haunted house?
There was a rather sticky silence as the Black Widowers stared furtively at each other.
Darienzi waited a moment, then said lightly, I withdraw the question. Everyone has seen enough haunted house movies in childhood to scar the soul of even the boldest.
But, said Halstead, do you actually sleep in these houses?
Of course not, said Darienzi. You simply spend the night there. After all, you have to stay awake if you're going to be aware of any manifestations. Besides that, the condition of haunted houses is not generally conducive to sleep. The houses are old and full of creaks. The rooms are musty, the beds rickety, and the mattresses beneath contempt. I doubt that anyone, even a posturing daredevil, could actually sleep in one of your typical haunted houses unless he were in the last stages of extreme fatigue.
I don't suppose you ever came across any manifestations.
If you mean anything that could be counted as firm evidence of ghostly or paranormal activity, of course not. The true believers always maintain that the manifestations are best received by sensitives, and that skeptics are too coarse-fibered to receive the delicate vibrations or whatever. That, however, is only another way of saying that manifestations are received most easily by people who are credulous and suggestible, and we all know that. Sometimes, to be sure, manifestations take place that are apparent even to my coarse-fibered, skeptical nature, and then I must nail them firmly to natural causes. I'm usually able to do that, but once I almost failed, and I was then in the position Jeff found himself in when he was poked in the hotel room.
Ah, said Gonzalo with sudden satisfaction. Now you're talking. Tell us about it.
I intend to, said Darienzi, because it happened last August in the little town in Vermont where I was using my friend's summer home.
You mean, said Gonzalo, there was a haunted cabin there, as your friend had said?
Yes, there was, and it gave me quite a turn.
Avalon looked surprised.
You didn't tell me this, Marcellus.
No, I had no occasion to. But after you told me your locked room experience this afternoon, and I could see it was your reason for inviting me to the banquet, I thought it would be fitting to tell the story, since it matched yours so well.
Very well, then. Tell it from the beginning, Marcellus.
Certainly, said Darienzi.
I drove there the evening before my formal occupancy was to begin and moved my baggage into the house. I was observed by some of the locals as I drove there, but they showed no curiosity. Harry loaned out his cottage for periods of time nearly every summer, and apparently the locals were used to the succession of city fellows that came there. Besides, the locals kept themselves to themselves, as I found out. They were stolid and quiet, quite like the stereotype of the Vermont backwoodsman. They showed absolutely no interest in me socially, and that, as you can well imagine, was exactly what I wanted.
I found the cottage in good shape, electricity on, water flowing, a gas range in working order, a comfortably large refrigerator freezer, but nothing to eat, if you don't count a half-empty tin of coffee in the pantry. That was no problem, of course. The next morning I drove down to the village store about 3/4 of a mile away and stocked up with 2 weeks of supplies. I did so rather munificently, getting rather more than I needed because I intended to leave some items in Weinstein's freezer as a sort of rent for the cottage. The storekeeper scared up almost everything I asked for. I then spent what I can only describe as a delicious 2 weeks working on my book, with my papers, notes, and reference materials scattered about me. No one disturbed me, and the weather, except for one dreary day of rain and wind, was fine. When the time came to leave, I was quite regretful.
Gonzalo said, Don't leave yet. What about the haunted cabin?
I'm getting to that. Each evening, except for the rainy one, I'd walk to the village and back,
partly for exercise and partly to buy perishables. I exchanged a few remarks on the weather with any locals I met, and they replied non-committally. They were polite, if not communicative, except in the matter of the haunted cabin. Then they unbent as far as a Vermonter could unbend. They were willing to point out its location, for instance. I asked them what the haunting consisted of. They didn't know, or wouldn't say. Apparently, city fellows had occasionally spent time in the cabin, and one old local man said he had heard tell that strange noises and sounds could be heard in the cabin. I was suspicious of the whole deal, but did my best not to show it. For one thing, the cabin was old, but not very old. It was not in a dilapidated state. For another thing, there were no stories to account for the haunting, and I considered that very odd. Your haunted house invariably comes with a dark tale of lust, cruelty, murder, or betrayal to account for the haunting, and the deeds almost always date back at least 2 centuries. Without it, I suspected bald-faced fakery.
Avalon said, "Why? What kind of fakery?"
Darienzi smiled grimly. I felt quite firmly that the whole thing was homegrown and of recent vintage. It was invented by the natives themselves as a kind of tourist attraction. I later found out that the village inn had prospered greatly in the last several years, and the Burlington newspapers had run several articles on the haunted cabin. The thing was their Loch Ness monster, if you know what I mean. Gonzalo snapped his fingers in frustration. "Damn! Then you're saying there was no haunted cabin after all?" "Of course not," said Darienzi. "Did you think there would be? Even if the cabin were an old dilapidated wreck and had once been owned by a wicked farmer who abused and killed his innocent wife, do you think it would be haunted? Really haunted? Besides, I haven't finished the story. On the last evening there, I intended to inspect the so-called haunted cabin. The storekeeper had the key, and he surrendered it to me at my request early in the day, with as near a smile as his habitually dour expression permitted. 'Here you are, sir,' he said. I'm sure he then spread the story, and the locals looked forward with anticipation to scaring me and having another story for the Burlington papers, and another infusion of wealth for the village. I inspected the house quickly and superficially by day. I didn't want any spying local to get too suspicious about the professionalism of the kind of search I might make. It was very ordinary, with the usual air of quiet and loneliness that long-deserted houses have. I found nothing unusual. After nightfall, I returned. There was no electricity, of course. You can't have that in a haunted house. Ghosts are, in any case, the children of the wavering, flickering shadows of the hearth fire. The steady light of electric bulbs is sure death to ghosts. It was necessary to investigate the house by flashlight, but I had a good one. I now gave the house a real inspection, foot by foot and inch by inch. I had no trouble discovering the wiring and the microphones. I suppose the local TV repairman had set it up and was under the impression he had done a good job, but he could scarcely expect to fool the trained and practiced eye. Gonzalo said, "Then it was just as fake as you expected, and an obvious fake, too." "Why are you surprised?" asked Darienzi. "All haunted houses are fakes, but very few, I admit, as obviously so as this one." "I suppose," said Drake, looking thoughtful, "that there was no point in lingering after that." "On the contrary," said Darienzi, "I felt it important to stay the night. I was curious as to the sort of manifestations they would manufacture for me. Surely they hadn't wired the place for nothing. And it's a good thing I did, because, as I told you at the beginning, they did startle me. I took off my jacket and shoes and sat in the one chair that looked as though it would bear my weight and be reasonably comfortable. Then I waited."
"Staying up all night is no fun," muttered Trumbull.
"I didn't stay up all night," said Darienzi. "The manifestations came long before the night was over."
"What were they?" asked Gonzalo eagerly.
"Nothing more than my name," said Darienzi. "There was an eerie whisper with just a trace of sound that told me it was coming in over a microphone. Marcellus Darienzi. Marcellus Darienzi." Then a pause, then again. It was repeated 4 times altogether, and the last repetition of my name was allowed to die away into a 3rd screech that sounded like "beware." It was all very primitive. When I decided the show was over at about 2 a.m., I got up, left, went to Harry's, and slept the rest of the night in comfort. By mid-morning, I was cleaning up and packing, and by mid-afternoon, I left for New York. Drake said, "Did anyone ask what had happened the night before?" "No. They saw me and knew I was alive, but they knew what had happened, and I didn't feel any great need to discuss it." Gonzalo writhed in his seat and finally said, "I don't want to insult you, but that's a pretty dull ghost story." Darienzi didn't seem the least insulted. "Actually," he said, "the ghost story had not yet begun. I was some 20 miles away from the village when it suddenly struck me like an alarm in the night. I had to pull the car over to the side of the road and start thinking." Avalon frowned.
"Thinking about what, Mark?"
"Don't you get it, Jeff? Once you found out your wife was all right, you suddenly realized you had to get to the true point, who had poked you. And once I found out that the house was a patent fake, I suddenly realized I had to get to the true point, too."
"Which was?" said Gonzalo.
"Which was, how did they know my name?" There was a general look of surprise about the table, and a fleeting smile crossed Henry's face. Drumble put the general thought into words, growling,
"Why shouldn't they know your name?"
"Because I never gave it to anybody in the village," said Darienzi, "and not one of them ever asked. I told you I've made a fetish of anonymity in connection with my work all my professional life. I was there to write my book, not to publicize myself. I told no one my name. I regretted allowing anyone to see me, even." "Do you see the problem this creates? The true believers of psychic phenomena are sometimes forced to admit fakery is involved, but they are then likely to insist that true paranormal effects are produced even in the midst of trickery. Well then, despite all the wiring, despite the microphonic equipment, did something really paranormal take place? How could anyone have known my name?"
Trumbull said, "I don't think there's much mystery, Marcellus. You must have told someone your name."
"Rely on me," said Darienzi stiffly. "I didn't tell anyone my name."
"In that case," said Trumbull, "someone must have recognized you."
"I can't believe that. I have very few photos of myself, and none at all for distribution." Halstead said, "They might have seen you, not your photograph. After all, you must give talks about your labors, and if you ever gave a talk in Burlington, someone from the village may have happened to—" Darienzi registered annoyance. "You haven't listened to me. I hold my anonymity sacred. I don't give talks, and I certainly never talked in Burlington."
Reuben said, "Yours is not a common name, so they couldn't have made a lucky guess."
"It's unthinkable that they would."
Reuben said, "Was the name pronounced correctly?"
Darienzi's face relaxed into a smile. "Good for you. Actually, both names were mispronounced. Marcellus was stressed on the first syllable rather than the second, while Darienzi was given a long I sound at the close."
"Which means," said Reuben, "that this so-called ghost saw your name but had never heard it pronounced."
"Exactly," said Darienzi. "I came to the same conclusion."
"Which leads me to think," said Reuben, "that someone broke into your friend's summer house and ransacked your papers and belongings for your name."
"I'm sure that isn't so," said Darienzi. "They couldn't have ransacked the house without disturbing my papers, and I would have noticed that at once. Besides, as it happened, I didn't have my name on anything there."
"Well then," said Gonzalo, with more than a trace of satisfaction, "you're in Jeff's position. You're forced to consider the paranormal."
"I'm more in Jeff's position than you think, Mario, for like Jeff, I solved the problem. Or at least I found a satisfactory solution that involved nothing beyond the natural."
"And what was that?" asked Avalon.
Darienzi said cheerfully, "Do none of you see it? It's much simpler than Jeff's solution and doesn't involve personal quirks that no one but the solver would be expected to know." There was a longish pause, and Drake shook his head.
"I'm afraid you've got us, unless Henry has a suggestion."
"Henry," said Gonzalo abruptly, "what's the answer?"
Henry, from his quiet station at the sideboard, said, "If I may be permitted to say so, gentlemen, the solution was obvious from the start."
"Was it?"
said D'Arienzi, a little captiously. I'm afraid so. At the beginning of your stay in Vermont, you bought 2 weeks' supplies and more at the village store. At today's prices, it may well have come to a sizable bit of money.
It did, said D'Arienzi, beginning to smile. And surely, considering our plastic culture, you did not pay in cash.
D'Arienzi broke into a roar of laughter.
Got it! You got it! Of course I didn't pay cash. I shoved over my credit card.
And your name was on it, said Henry. And your signature had to be placed on the slip they stamped, and it was so common and ordinary an action that you thought nothing of it, and didn't recall it at once later on. I'm afraid it is much more difficult to be anonymous in our modern society than we imagine.